So tonight is the beginning of a long series of talks I'm going to give on the 10 paramis. The 10 paramis are basically, sometimes the word parami is sometimes directed, translated as perfections or perfections of the heart or perfections of the heart mind. There's lots of different ways it's translated. And the first thing I want to really point out is the word perfection is very dangerous. So don't feel like any of this, you have to be perfect. We don't want to go there. It's perfection is just a way to get yourself in trouble. But basically what the paramis are is a progressive sort of step-by-step description of how the path might unfold. And you see how one thing leads to the next as we go along. And basically the reason for the path, the reason why are we doing this is in the classic imagery in the Buddhist time, he talked a lot about the what he called crossing the flood. That this whole practice is about crossing the flood. The flood being that both an image for difficult water that's hard to get across, especially in his day where there weren't a lot of bridges or anything or ferries even, you had to sort of somehow get across, right? But it's also a very good description of what arises as we sit quietly and experience what's going on. What we experience is a flood of thoughts and emotions and physical sensations, and it seems to be, and actually is, never ending. And so there's this great thing in the sutta, which is one of my favorite passages where the Buddha talks about this idea of crossing the flood. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll read the first couple sections of it. And he's basically describing what this process is like in very metaphorical terms. Bhikkhus, that's us, right? Suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water whose near shore was dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore was safe and free from fear. But there was no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. So this is like the near shore in this image is day-to-day experience, essentially. And the far shore is where we've got to the place where we're not overwhelmed by day-to-day experience. It's one way to put it anyway. Then he thought, this is a great expanse of water, whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, whose far shore is safe and free from fear. But there's no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the other shore. So here he's describing, well, he's sort of formed the intention to get across to the other side. And then he just sort of looks around and sees what's at hand right now. Like he doesn't need anything special. He's not going to go off and build an ark or a big boat or anything like that. He's going to take a bunch of grass and twigs and bind them all together and make something that'll float enough that he can lie on it. But he says, and it's really important, he said, and making an effort with my hands and feet. In other words, he's going to sort of, he has to put energy, he has to put effort into crossing the flood. This is what we have to do in this practice, right? And then the man collected grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and bound them together into a raft. And supported by the raft and making an effort with his hands and feet, he got safely across to the far shore. Then, when he had got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus, this raft has been very useful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulders and then go wherever I want. Now, because what do you think? By doing so, would that man be doing what should be done with that raft? No, venerable sir. By doing what would that man be doing what should be done with that raft? Here, because when the man got across and arrived at the far shore, he might think thus. This raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it onto dry land, or set it adrift in the water, and then go wherever I want. So, what's the Buddha getting at here? He's getting at two things. One is this effort, this to get across to the far shore. It requires effort. You have to do something. You can't just sort of sit around and think about it. It's an energetic process. And the twigs and the grass and all that, in some sense, like I said, it's like what's available right now, but it's also an image for the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha. There's this like this vast collection of stuff, and when you bind it all together, you'll get a raft that'll take you across the flood, right? But then you get across, and then you have to let the raft go. Which I think is really interesting, and it's something you don't see often in spiritual teaching, where it's basically saying, well, once you've accomplished what needs to be done, you don't need the teachings anymore. The teachings are just skillful means. They're tools that allow us to go to the other side. That's what has to be done. So, you know, it's not like, and so you don't, you know, pick up the thing and carry it around with you for the rest of your life. Now you go, okay, I've accomplished something now. I don't need this anymore. And it fascinates me that that's what the Buddha says. That he says, these teachings are skillful means. They're useful. They're going to get you across. And then you just like everything else, they're impermanent and you let them go. And so all of this teachings on the 10 paramis, I'm heading somewhere here, right? All these teachings on the 10 paramis, we want to take them in and see how useful they are, how they can be skillful means to get us across to the other shore. But that's what they are. We don't want to sort of make them into some extra special super duper thing that we should engrave in tablets and, you know, stick on our wall. They're just skillful means or useful teachings or a way of looking at how we can make progress. I also want to read something from this book. It's called Parami by Ajahn Susito. Ajahn Susito is the abbot of a Theravadan Buddhist monastery in England. And this is a book that his students helped him put together. And he's talking about this image of the flood, right? So floods. Our experience is a meeting and merging of external and internal currents of events. It's an interesting way of saying what happens when we meditate, right? Is a meeting and merging of external and internal currents of events. The awareness of something out there triggers a moment of recognition as to what the thing is. Piece of music, an old friend, a familiar flavor, along with degrees of interest, pleasure, or alarm that may act as further triggers to action to draw closer, start talking, or search one's memory for further information about that thing. This internal experience normally occupies our attention, sometimes to the point of congestion, as our mind adds a swelling amount of internal activity to the ongoing flow of external data. This is in Pali, this is called papancha. It's called proliferation. When some little thing happens, and then the mind creates an enormous amount of story about that little thing. And it, as he says, it clogs us. The mind has creative potential, but that isn't always a happy experience. At times, the internal analysis, active analysis, speculation, memory, investigation, Cross-referencing, decision-making, and self-evaluation can amount to a volume of overwhelming proportions. Then the experience of overload develops into one of exhaustion, or of a pressure in our lives that diminishes peace and joy, and can incline the mind towards temporary oblivion, or need for therapy to find some way to manage the daily round. This is the loss of balance that we can rightly experience as being flooded. It isn't the world per se, nor is it that we are chronically unbalanced. It's just that the right relationship hasn't been struck. So he's saying that normal experience we have of being overwhelmed is just because we haven't found a way to balance out the external, the experience with the rest of our life. And of course he goes on and says, on the other hand, we may have an experience of aware stillness in which the concerns of the day and all those habitual inner activities stopped or abated. Perhaps it was in the presence of a natural wonder, or maybe it was in a temple or under a night sky where we felt for a moment lifted by awe. For a few instants or minutes, perhaps, our normal sense of who we are, a sense based on the movement and concern of all that mental activity, dropped away and was replaced by a sense of great breadth or depth or a feeling of one with the universe. In such an experience, the world around us changes to a place of beauty or spiritual presence. Maybe we framed the experience in the language of a particular religion or interpreted it as a divine revelation. It could have triggered a whole range of further activities. Or we could have surmised that there are other states of consciousness that we've called ordinary, and that the normal self that we experience as being in the world is not a fixed and ultimate identity. For a moment, without creating or rejecting anything, we experience the shift both in terms of ourself and the world around us. And I would like to submit that what he's talking about is something that we've all experienced. If we hadn't experienced this shift, we wouldn't be here having this time together. It's something that, and then he goes on a little bit more. Now, if we find a method of experiencing such shifts and stopping on a regular basis, we could examine that sense of stopping and know that it's anything but nihilistic. It's not oblivion, but a vibrant stillness. So here he's talking, of course, about the practice of meditation. And so that's how we cross the flood. That's the process in the broadest sense, you know, where we find a way to get the mind to slow down, to be a little still, to stop proliferating, or at least be able to see the proliferation and not be overwhelmed by it, to see the constant flood of things and go, oh, that's okay. Not have to figure it out or make it into something or decide something about it, just to be aware of it. So that's the idea. That's the idea behind the paramis. The paramis are essentially just a way of looking at what we're experiencing and how we can make that shift to a place where the mind is still or stiller. And so let's start actually looking at the paramis themselves. The first two have to do with nothing other than how we live in the world. And this is very typical of the Buddhist teachings. The Buddha always starts with, oh wait, get your life in order. Get your physical daily life in order. And then you can have the chance to have the mind go still and practice. If your life in the world isn't in order, if there's chaos in your daily life, it's pretty hard to then go sit someplace and have the mind go still, because that chaos will just manifest while you're sitting. So the first two paramis then are dana and sila. Dana means generosity, and sila means something like ethical life, or, and there's a variety of, I'll talk more about that later. And this is, whenever the Buddha went to a new place, these are the first things he always taught to householders and to people who are potentially going to become monastics as well. And the idea of dana, of generosity, of being able to give freely, is emphasized for two particular reasons. First is that anyone, no matter the level of education or their level of intelligence or their amount of free time or whatever, no one is constrained from being generous. It's just something that anyone can do. And that's part of the reason. So the Buddha taught this so that people could, everyone could feel like, oh, I can do that. I can participate at least at that level. I can sort of connect with this. So it was a way for everybody to connect into the teachings right away. But the second reason is, it's a direct antidote. Generosity is a direct antidote to grasping, to clinging to things, to wanting more. It's the opposite. It's like, you know, the image is always, you know, we tend to be like this with our fist clenched, holding on to stuff. And when we're generous, we have to open our hand and let things go. It's a different action physically. And this frees us in a sense, this sense of, you know, it breaks our traditional habitual patterns. You know, when you think about our culture, right? And how we often define ourselves is by the stuff we have, right? I've got this cool car, or this nice house, or this great job, or this wonderful partner, or this latest electronic gizmo. That's who I am. That's how we often start defining ourselves. All these things are mine, right? We cling to them, we grasp them, we cling to them. Aren't so our self-image is propped up by what we own. And they sort of help us define our status and our rank in society relative to everyone else, of course. I had a student once who wore this great t-shirt all the time. It said, "The person with the most toys when they die wins." And that sort of describes how we're encouraged to think by our culture. And generosity allows us to shift that pattern into thinking of our possessions as just stuff. They're not mine, they're just stuff. I have this stuff now because I need it now to function in the world. Because we're householders, we live in the world, we need stuff. Even monastics had a certain amount, very limited amount of stuff that they had. They had a robe and a bowl and a staff and you know, a shelter where they could sleep at night, sort of thing. So, you know, we're householders, we have a little larger set of needs, perhaps. But it's just stuff. We use it now because we need it now to do what we do. And then if we're thinking of it as just stuff, it's not mine, then we don't mind just letting it go when we don't need it anymore. Just let it go. Don't cling to it. But so generosity also sort of helps us connect to the fact that, oh, wait, I don't need this anymore, but somebody else could use this. And somebody else probably even needs it. So if I let it go, it sort of connects me with others, with a sense of we're all sort of connected together in some web. We also, when we, so, but we have to be careful about this. So when we're being generous, we have to do it gladly. We have to do it with a sense of joy. It's not like, oh, well, I guess I gotta give something because it's my duty. It shouldn't be grim. It should be joyful. And the quality of our feelings when we give really affects the process and the receiver of what we're giving. There's this great story from the Buddhist time about this king. This was happened apparently during one of the what's called the rains retreats. Rainy season, the Buddha and all his disciples would gather together in some place for what was called the rains retreat, which would go on for 2 or 3 months. The length of the rainy season, because they couldn't wander, because the paths, and normally all the monks were wanderers, but they all came together and studied with the Buddha and practiced together. And there was this very famous banker who was a very devoted householder disciple of the Buddha, and he would feed the bhikkhus every day. He'd feed, according to the scripture, 500 bhikkhus every day. Bhikkhus weren't allowed to grow food or carry food more than not very far, like 4 or 5 miles, or store food overnight. They were totally dependent on the generosity of the villagers, the householders, to take care of them. And so this famous banker and guy would, every day the monks would come and there'd be food for 500 of these monks and nuns. And the local king heard about this, and he was like, "Whoa, this banker guy, I'm way more important than him. I'm the king, right? I can feed all these people too." And so he ordered his cooks to prepare all his food and announced that he was going to feed all the bhikkhus. And the bhikkhus all came, and they took the food, and then they walked away. And part of the whole thing about feeding the bhikkhus was you got the honor and also the joy of seeing them eat it. And instead, the monks would take the food and walk away. And the king was like, "What's going on here? How come, they're not just sitting down and eating the food? They're carrying the food away, and they're not eating it. I can't ever get this, have the joy of seeing them actually eat it." Turns out that the monks were taking the food and they were going away with it and finding another householder, giving it directly to the householders, and then the householder would gladly give it back to them. And then they could eat it because it was given to them with the right attitude. The king was giving it because he wanted to feel important, and I'm a big guy. So the monks would take the food and then give it away, literally give it away to somebody else who would then give it back to them. And then they could eat it. It would be okay. So it's like that energy of how we give is really an important part of the whole thing. It can't be done with a sense of obligation of, this is, I'm doing this because it's the right thing to do, or I'm doing this because I'm going to get my name in the newspaper about being this really generous guy. None of that can't, doesn't work. We have to consciously give just because it feels right. It's the right, it feels, it creates happiness. In fact, there's this really interesting thing about giving. There's what's called the three times when you experience joy if you perform a generous act. There's the time when you're thinking about doing it. Ever thought about doing some generous thing? And it's just like something about just thinking about it makes you happy. It feels right. And then there's the time of actually giving, the actual process of putting it into someone's hands. And that always feels good. And then there's the time afterwards when you're sort of just thinking about it after that you've done it, and that just brings you more gladness. Not in the sense of, oh, aren't I great because I gave something. It's just like, that was a good thing to do, and I feel it feels wholesome. It's a wholesome memory. There's another thing we have to think about generosity, however, and that's that we have to let other people give us things. It's really important that we allow other people to be generous, to experience that joy that I just talked about. You know, if someone comes and it offers us something, just say yes. What happens, of course, is we look at it and we get caught in this thinking of, well, I don't really need that anyway. Or we look at the person and say, well, they really can't afford to give this. Or, you know, whatever we politely, in quotes, refuse what they're offering. And this is incredibly ungenerous. It's like it breaks the cycle of generosity, number one, and it reinforces our own sense of how I don't need this stuff. I'm superior. I don't need this stuff. We creates a sense of up of I'm up someplace. This person's giving me this stuff, you know. So we just have, whenever someone offers us something, just take it. Say thank them for it. Let them experience that joy of generosity. And then if you don't need it, now it's yours, give it away. That's okay. It just passes, you're like the it flows through you, you know, but you've allowed that person to be generous. And the last thing I want to talk about is generosity doesn't mean just giving money, or doesn't just deal with material things. In our culture, especially as householders and living in the world like we do, one of the most generous things we can do is give our time. That commodity we always are trying to figure out how we can sort of get the most of, right? How can I have more free time? To give some of that, quote, free time away. Just give it away to someone who needs it more. There are, if you start looking in the world for more than 30 seconds, an enormous amount of places that are just so happy to have someone come and volunteer and give some time. And we once again, we have to do this with just like no expectation of anything, of reward or giving. Just here's something that needs to be done. Let's go do it. I grew up in a Boy Scout family, believe it or not. My father was a Boy Scout leader, and my brother and me, and this is like, and there was like whole thing was the Boy Scout thing. It was like generosity was like a really big thing, and it's stuck with me all my life, and it always brings me joy. It always brings me joy. So I've done a lot of different things, you know, helping out in different organizations and that sort of thing. But it's like it's so easy to do. You just have to go, oh, these 2 hours where normally I'd be hanging out reading my favorite book and reading music or doing one, you know, going hiking or doing whatever I would, some fun thing. I'm gonna give those that time away and go load food in bags in a food bank or like I say, look around, absolutely endless possibilities out there. People, there are all kinds of organizations who would just be thrilled to have you come and volunteer. And this is generosity that has nothing to do with that. Once again, doesn't mean you have to be have any money or be wealthy or rich. Nothing. All it is I'm going to give my time, which is a commodity in this world. I mean, you know, in our culture, having, you know, time and giving it away is like, oh my God, you know, I'm so busy all the time. How can I possibly find time to do that too? So here's the thing, on one last note, that generosity is actually quite easy to practice. We just have to consciously take the many opportunities that are presented to us every day to be generous. Just do it. Don't think it's like, because as we deepen our generosity, we actually break down our need to grasp, our to hold on to things, and our sense of separation from others. Because especially if we're doing something on a volunteer basis and helping other people, we're connecting to other people in a very direct way. That says they're no different from me. Just because they have to come to the food bank to get food, and I'm the guy putting the food in the bags, we're just the same. We start to see that more and more as we, practice in this way. Another little bit. This is something Joseph Goldstein said once, when I was sitting with him, and it just struck me as like, oh my God, how true could that be? He would say, he said, he's made himself a total practice. Whenever the thought of giving arises in his mind, he does it right away. Don't stop. Don't hesitate. Don't think, oh, I better figure this out and blah, blah, blah. Just do it. He says it always feels good. Just if that impulse is there, follow through right away. Do it. Then we come to the second of these two, which is sila. As I said, it's sometimes translated as ethical behavior. The word I like, kind of an old-fashioned word, is virtue. We need to practice being virtuous. And virtue is often confused with morality. I'm not talking about morality. Morality is like a set of rules. Do this, do that. Follow these rules. And virtue is more like, look at things from this side, from this angle, from this way. Think of things in this way. And see how that, by sort of trying to live, but trying to practice these based on these guidelines of how to lead a virtuous life, how your life becomes better, how the mind goes stiller. So morality is like this wagging finger, like, no, do this and do that, and don't do this and don't do that. And virtue is like a finger that points us, just go this way. Same finger, different action, right? It's like it's just saying, try this out and see how it works. Practice this and see what happens. There's no demand anymore. There's just suggestion that this makes sense to follow these ideas. And it's always the first step. This is another section from the Majjhima Nikaya. And here the Buddha is talking to someone who's involved in another form of practice. And he's asking the Buddha, how is it possible? How come your monastics are all so wonderful? How come your students are all so wonderful? Can you describe to me how you train them so that they're all so wonderful? And this is the Buddha starts by responding this way. It is possible, Brahman, to describe gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual process in this Dhamma and discipline. Just as Brahman, when a clever horse trainer obtains a fine, thoroughbred colt. So this is the Buddha, once again, using images that everyone would understand in the culture he was part of, right? He first makes him get used to wearing the bit and afterwards trains him further. So when the Tathagata, himself, obtains a person to be tamed, he first disciplines him thus, come, bhikkhus, be virtuous. Be restrained with the restraint of an enlightened being. Be careful and perfect in conduct and resort and seeing fear in the slightest fault. Train by taking the training precepts. Now, in the monastic world, the training precepts were like 127 of them. It's like a huge long list. So, but we're not monastic, so it's okay. There's only five we have to think about. But this is what the fascinating thing is. This is what he says is, this is the first thing I always did. This is the first thing, because this is what everybody had to do. They had to learn to lead a virtuous life. Because once they learned a virtuous life, then the mind starts to go still. Why is that? Well, think about it. If you lead a virtuous life, then you don't have regrets. You don't have sorrow. You don't have to worry about someone's going to, you know, oh, well, you know, someone's going to catch me and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's something the Buddha called this the bliss of blamelessness sometimes. The sense of just, I don't have anything to worry about. Because all my actions are based on virtue. It's an interesting way to think about it. So traditionally in the Theravada world, virtue is talked about by what's called the five precepts. Now these are what he talked about by following the precepts. They're, like I said, there was like 130, 127, I don't know, some huge number that monks had to follow and nuns. As householders, there's only five. So it's much simpler to remember. And the most important thing I want to say before I even read the list is we have, just like generosity, we have to think of the precepts as things we practice. These aren't rules. These aren't do it or else. These are practices, which means as we practice, we explore them, we think about what they mean in our lives, we practice them, and sometimes we're going to fall short. Sometimes we're going to be less than perfect. If we were perfect, we wouldn't have to practice anymore. Right? But we have to practice these things because we're moving towards something. Anyhow, I just wanted to point this out before I even read the list. So here's the list. Non-harming. Don't harm anything. And so just I'll talk about this very quickly. Think about this. I mean, on one level, you know, that's like don't kill anything, right? But harming is more than just killing, right? I mean, think about it. You know, in one of my favorite ones these days, in ecological terms, there are the things I do that harm the environment, which harms other beings. Oh, maybe I shouldn't do that anymore. You know, so it's like it becomes all of these paramis, all of these precepts become things we have to think about and how they relate to our lives. What does it mean to be non-harming in this world? That should be as much as non-harming as much as we can. That's why it's a practice, because we're sort of evolving and figuring it out as we go along. So non-harming, right? And then the next one is taking only what is offered. Well, in the monastic world, that would mean, you know, remember the monks didn't own anything. They couldn't, they every day they'd go with their bowl and people would put food in their bowl, but they could only take what was offered. They couldn't sort of go around picking things out in people's gardens and asking for more. And, oh no, can you give me some chili sauce with that? You know, it was like whatever was offered, that's what they got. In our householder world, this is more, I think, the idea being don't have more stuff than you need. But we all need stuff, and we have to acknowledge that too. You know, for a number of years, I worked as a carpenter, and I still have tools. But it's like at one point, I had six different kinds of saws. But I actually needed, for the kinds of the work I was doing, I actually needed all these saws, but I only had one of each. I knew guys who had like three. Oh, I saw a new one and it's even better. And you know, it's like you have to sort of learn to go, no, just enough. I just need enough stuff to function, to do what I do in the world with my life. And that's it. You know, so it's like, you know, you got to be careful you don't start turning this into, well, you know, no one needs a car. You know, no one needs, you know, whatever it is you don't need. You know, I mean, some people like to live that way, like sort of more strictly, but it can turn into, you know, sort of beating yourself up and sort of masochistic ways almost. You know, it's, we need to have a place, a roof over our head and food on our table and whatever tools we need to do the work we do and that sort of thing. Just be careful about not accumulating more than you need. And back to the list here. Not using wrong speech. It's a very broad category. Typically, wrong speech, when the list that was often you see is don't speak harshly, don't speak falsely, don't gossip, and don't just have what's called useless speech. Just don't babble, you know, blah, 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 talking, talking, talking with all the time. And in our culture, this also means the internet, you know, speech. The internet is a huge world of speech. And we have to be very careful there as much as in our verbal speech. And then two more. Refraining from sexual misconduct. It's an interesting one. What does that mean in this context? Well, once again, for monastics, it meant celibacy, but we're a householder, so that's not what it means. Instead, what it means is, let's look at what this means in terms of the other precepts. Sexual misconduct might be harming. Sexual conduct must not cause harm. Shouldn't be taking what isn't offered. It's pretty obvious what that means within a context of sexual conduct. It shouldn't mean it's something you boast about or gossip about later. And then the final one of these is not abusing alcohol and intoxicants that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. Think about that in terms of sexual misconduct, where they're basically saying, well, you shouldn't be high or drunk, or the other person shouldn't be high or drunk, because when you're in those mind states, you're not going to make clear decisions. So you can see how all these things relate to each other as well. The interesting thing about this one, about sexual misconduct, however, notice there's nothing here about, oh, only between a man and a woman. Or, oh, only between just two people, for that matter. Or, oh, no, only for with the man in control and for making babies. You know, all those sort of, you know, finger wagging morality stuff that goes on in our culture, if we're not careful. It's saying, and there's none. The Buddha never talked about any of those things. Never came up. He always talked with these things in the context of the others. There was nothing going on there that the Buddha would talk about ever. And that's part of the reason I like this particular teaching so much. It's just a way of framing how to, you know, because sexuality is such a powerful, wonderful thing, and also a place where it's really easy to go off the rails. And if you think about it in this framework, it's like, oh, this all makes sense. All fits together much better. So that's the precepts themselves. And it's a way to, and I wanted to go back to what I said at the very beginning. All of these things I just talked about are all practices. They aren't rules or laws or do this or else. There's none of that. It's like, if I'm going to practice the precepts, I have to actually consciously think about how these things relate to how I lead my life. And every time I make a big decision or even a small decision, like I have to go, how does that fit in with the precepts? How does that fit in with the world and how I'm living in the world, and pause at that point and go, oh, okay. But I just want to emphasize, this is the Buddha talked about this not just because it's to make us good people. It's because both these practices, dana and sila, led towards the mind being still, which was the first step towards practice. But there's places, many places where he talks about this, and this, Buddha's famous for lists, right? This is a list from the what's called the Anguttara Nikaya, and it's which is a collection of the Buddha's teachings. And he starts this starts with virtue, this list, and ends with enlightenment. But it's this very step by step, and you see how one thing leads to the next, right? I just want to read this a little bit of sutta. Virtuous ways of conduct have non-remorse as their benefit and reward. So non-remorse means the mind goes still, right? Non-remorse has gladness as its benefit and reward. Gladness has joy as its benefit and reward. Joy has serenity as its benefit and reward. Happiness has meditative concentration as its benefit and reward. Meditative concentration has knowing and seeing things as they really are as its benefit and reward. Knowing and seeing things as they really are has non-attachment as its benefit and reward. Non-attachment has liberation as its benefit and reward. In this way, virtuous ways of conduct lead step by step to the highest. And this is just one example of the many places where you'll find it in the Buddha's teachings, where he's talking about virtue and the importance of virtue. So we have to of course look at the dark side here. What's the danger of virtuous thinking? I've always it's like people sometimes call something like this situational ethics. Which in those two ideas are related. And the danger of looking at everything from a virtuous process conduct point of view is it's really easy, if we're not careful, into deluding ourselves into thinking, well, it's okay. Because our desire, our wanting to do something or say something overwhelms our sense of what's correct. So we have to watch ourselves. When we're practicing, we have to be aware of this tendency to let our brothers, what we really want for now, get in the way of things and get in the way of seeing things clearly. Advantage of morality, these nice clear guidelines, is it's easy. Just follow the rules. Just follow the rules. That's all you have to do. Just here's the rules that are laid out. Just follow the rules. The problem, however, with morality, and it's a big problem, is morality is almost always based on fear. Do this, follow these rules, or else you'll be damned. You'll go to hell. You'll be shunned by the community. You'll be thrown out of the community. There's all variations on that theme, but it's always fear-based. You have to be afraid of what's going to happen if you don't follow the rules. Fear is a really unwholesome mind state. If we're going to base our whole life based on making our decisions based on fear, it's going to be a pretty unhappy life. Because we're always going to be afraid of failing to follow the rules correctly. Whereas virtue is like, yeah, I understand this is a practice. I'm going to do the best I can, and sometimes I'm not going to be perfect, and then I'll learn from my mistakes and get better. It's a different way of looking at everything. Morality also has the sort of energy of people are basically bad and we have to constrain them. And virtue has this energy of people are basically good. And given these guidelines, they'll head in the right direction. It's a different psychology behind them, in a sense. So being virtuous may be more difficult than being moral. Because it requires that we think a lot more, that we actually look at everything we do and go, how does this fit into a virtuous life? It becomes how we make our decisions about how we do things in the world. Is this virtuous? And understanding what that means for us. But it's the underpinning of all everything else. That's why these are the first two paramis. The rest of the paramis, the other eight that we're going to talk about in successive weeks, all have to do with mental process. The first two are like, get your life in order in the world. And then the meditative process, as is explained in the next eight, has much more chance of being fruitful. But generosity and virtue are things we have to practice. There's this great little passage. This is the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada is these sort of poetic sayings of the Buddha. And it's this little bit I want to read. This is verses 18 and 19 from the Dhammapada. If he recites many teachings, but heedless man doesn't do what they say, like a cowherd counting the cattle of others, he has no share in the contemplative life. If he recites next to nothing, but following the Dhamma, in line with the Dhamma, abandoning passion, aversion, delusion, alert, his mind well released, not clinging, either here or hereafter, he has his share in the contemplative life. Says it all. You know, it's like so many people can talk the talk. You know, I mean, it's scary sometimes what you see people saying, and they don't live it. They'll talk about it, but they won't actually live it. And what the Buddha is talking about here is live it. It's your life to put in order. Live it out. That's what's important. And I come back to one last thing. Don't think you need to be perfect. Perfection is just a prescription for pain. Don't think you have to be perfect. Understand these are just practices. Take things one step at a time. All of these things, all of these ideas I've presented in terms of, you know, what the precepts of virtue are, they're all practices. And we start, as we go deeper into them, we start to see more and more, and we change how we live our life, slowly but surely. I'll give you one personal example that maybe makes this more concrete. I've been a vegetarian for about 50 years now. But when I was first a vegetarian, it was like, well, fish aren't really animals, so they're okay. And then I stopped eating fish. But I still ate a lot of dairy and cheese and those sorts of things. Because I liked them, and it's like a way to get protein, and, you know, how I baked and how I cooked. And, you know, I loved Italian food, which was kind of nice and cheesy. And so it was like vegetarian, but. And then I started paying more and more attention to the fact, part of this was because I at one point lived on the communal farm where we raised goats, you know, which we raised for milk, right? It was part of how we lived. But to get milk from a goat, a female goat has to get pregnant and have a baby, right? That's how you get animals give you milk. Well, any of the boy babies we had for goats, we had to sell them to someone who was basically looking for a nice goat meat meal or two. That's what was going on. So as soon as you start consuming dairy, you're actually creating the situation where a lot of animals are going to be eaten. Maybe not by you, but by other people. And this finally got to the point where it bothered me so much I thought about it over and over again. Then about 5 years ago, I became vegan and stopped eating any dairy at all. I just don't do it. This took me 50 years. Okay. So this is the process of following the precepts and trying to lead a virtuous life. And I'm not, by the way, saying you should become vegan. Don't everybody has to figure this stuff out for themselves and find their own way. But it's like that's this process. We're exploring what these things mean and then making our life more in alignment with what these precepts are, based on our understanding and how we come to see them more clearly. One last thing, of course, have to have a little bit of poetry here. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. And it speaks quite clearly to this idea of this is a process and be gentle with yourself and take it step by step. So the poem is called Walk Slowly. It only takes a reminder to breathe, a moment to be still. And just like that, something in me settles, softens, makes space for imperfection. The harsh voice of judgment drops to a whisper, and I remember again that life isn't a relay race, that we will all cross the finish line, that waking up to life is what we were born for. As many times as I forget, catch myself charging forward without even knowing where I'm going, that many times I can make the choice to stop, to breathe, to be, and walk slowly into the mystery. That's what we're doing. We're walking slowly. The key word might be slowly tonight. Walking slowly into the mystery. We're exploring this stuff and seeing what it means for us.